you could listen today. During this hour of the show, we will talk about nutrition for your animal companions. Our guest is Linda Case. She's a companion animal instructor at the University of Illinois, has written a great deal on this subject and deals with it every day, as she's also an animal companion herself. Can we say that?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Sure.
I'm a companion okay. to an animal. Several.
Usually we talk on the show about a variety of pet care issues, training and behavior and things like that. And we can still take those calls, but we're going to try to focus a bit on nutrition and how you can go about choosing a pet food and knowing what's in it and taking care of your animals the best way you can. So we'll focus on that a bit. And if you have questions, please give us a call. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. If you match the letters with the numbers, that's what you get. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. At any point, feel free to give us a call. Linda, thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks for asking me, Jack.
Sure.
Nice to be here again.
Yeah. Well, and there's a book that you loaned me to do a bit of reading that you were one of the authors of.
Mm-hmm.
Canine and Feline Nutrition, a Resource for Companion Animal Professionals, second edition. And there's some interesting stuff in there I did not know about. I mean, you go to the store, you buy your pet food, you might go to a feed store and feel a little better about it and so
right.
forth. But how do you know what you're getting? And in fact, it turns out that even if you buy the same food all the time, you may not know what you're getting.
Right. That's very true. I think that one of the things that people need to learn about canine and feline nutrition is that all pet foods are not the same. You know, there are certainly regulations in effect that govern what can and cannot be put into a pet food, but especially today, there's just a wide variety of quality of foods. And also something that's changed in the last 5 to 10 years is the fact that we know so much more. There's so much good science out there now about dog and cat nutrition that we've been able to formulate pet foods for specific life stages and for specific activity levels. Some companies even have started to design pet foods for certain breeds, which there are some positive and negative points to that. But the point is that a dog food is not a dog food is not a dog food, that we can be very specific in how we feed our animals and in how we promote optimal health.
Mm-hmm. One of the first things, we do have a caller waiting, and I promise I'll get to them in a second, but just to kind of map out the territory a little bit. One of the main things that people might look at, of course, are the labels mm-hmm. of the pet food and try to discern from that the content and the quality of what they're giving their pet. But even that can be a little bit,
I almost said misleading.
I almost said deceptive, but not
right.
fully revealing.
Yeah, it's not so much that it's misleading intentionally. Yeah. It's just that because of the restraints upon pet food manufacturers on what they can and cannot include in a label, they can only convey so much information, and that's limiting. And so one of the things that people tend to look at first is the guaranteed analysis panel. Americans tend to be obsessed with protein for some reason. We are for ourselves and we are for our animals. And as a result, we tend to overconsume protein as humans, and we tend to think our pets need more of it than they do as well. And certainly when you look at a guaranteed analysis panel, it's going to give you the minimum percentage of protein in that product. But it doesn't give you any information about the exact level of the nutrient, its minimum and maximums. And more importantly, it cannot give you information about the quality of that ingredient, of how digestible it is, the amino acid balance, basically how available those amino acids would be to the body. And that's a difficult issue for the pet food consumer, because there's really no way that they can know that from the label.
I'll continue to follow up on that, but we have a listener waiting. I don't want to make
sure.
them wait too long. Let's talk with someone from Champaign on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. My dog had she has a long black coat, and I shaved it this summer, and when it came back, it wasn't nearly as lustry and as shiny as it usually is. And she has a couple spots that hasn't grown back, and I'm mm-hmm. wondering if there could be anything in her diet. We've had her checked for her thyroid.
She has, okay.
For allergies, and...
How old is she?
She's seven.
Seven. What breed is she?
A chow mix.
So she probably had a pretty dense undercoat.
Mm-hmm.
And did you take off that undercoat as well?
Yeah.
Okay.
It gets so hot in the summer.
Sure. One of the things that could be happening, since it's growing back now and it's cold, you might be seeing just the undercoat growing back, and her guard hairs have not grown back completely yet.
The guard hairs are pretty long.
They are.
They're almost all the way back, and it's just really dull.
Mm-hmm. Have you had her checked for internal parasites? That would be another thing that...
I don't think the doctor did check that.
Yeah, I would do a fecal. And the reason that I'm going through these things, like as you said, you checked her thyroid, that would be the first thing that I would think of, is that 9 times out of 10, although we like to say it's nutrition, if the person's feeding a good food and the dog's been healthy, it's usually the coat is affected by other things more significantly than diet.
Okay.
Are you feeding her just a basic adult food?
Science diet, one of the higher fiber, lower protein ones.
Oh, okay.
And I give her lots of like seeds, bananas, and vegetables, and potatoes, and stuff like that.
Okay. And why are you giving her the high fiber science diet?
She has a hard time going to the bathroom. If she has too much, we had her on the more protein ones, like the IMES ones, and she
gets constipated.
Yeah.
Does she get much exercise?
Mm-hmm. She runs with me.
Oh, great. I guess my concern would be with a high fiber diet. Traditionally, high fiber diets had what are called insoluble fibers or non-fermentable fibers in them. Those fibers can inhibit the absorption of other nutrients and specifically some of the fats in the diet. So that could, typically those were used for older dogs that were prone to gaining weight. There's pretty good research showing that that's not the most efficacious way to keep dogs from gaining weight or to decrease their weight. So most pet food companies have stopped using that philosophy in their weight reduction diets. Instead, what we do now is we increase digestible carbohydrates and decrease fat, kind of similar to what a human should do.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a better and more efficient way of maintaining weight. So I guess my only concern with that diet would be that there is a possibility that she's at a slight nutrient deficiency because it's a high-fiber diet.
Okay.
But again, if she has problems with constipation and that's helped her, I would hate to say go back to a more digestible nutrient-dense diet and then have problems again.
Could we feed her a food like just one of the regular IMES or Science Diet or something like that with some other source of fiber that would be better for her?
You could add some bran or something to the diet. I would just be careful how much I would add, just so that, again, you don't go down the same route. I would have her feces checked for internal parasites,
okay. Just
to be sure. And you said she's 7 years old. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I personally would do is, was that the first time you ever had shaved her?
No, we did it the year before, and she was fine.
Oh, and she was. Okay. Because I would also wonder if perhaps she just hasn't gone through a complete coat cycle yet.
No, it's been a while. We had to took her in 2.5-3 months ago when it wasn't growing back.
Sure, sure. Yeah, I would have her checked for intestinal parasites. The two that come to mind are tapeworm could certainly cause that, and if she consumed a flea or even ate a beetle or something, they can pick up tapeworms. If you take her out and she might eat carrion, that they can pick up tapeworms.
Mm-hmm.
The other one is whipworm. Whipworm can be very insidious in that they can carry a very low number of whipworm, and you can see, usually you'll see some diarrhea, but you can see coat changes just from a very low level of infection. So I would do that first, I guess, and then if you're sure all health, everything, she's definitely healthy, then you might want to change diets.
Okay. Great. Thanks very much.
You're welcome. Okay.
Thanks very much for the call, and good luck. So we're talking about nutrition and selecting pet foods and so forth. We could talk a bit about, grocery stores versus feed stores and so forth. But, sort of stepping back a little bit, the whole concept of pet food is relatively recent anyway.
Yeah, it is.
I think it's interesting to read that.
The history.
In the book. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. We tend to think that they've been around forever. And I think one of the most interesting things to me was that when we first started manufacturing dog and cat foods, the same food was put into bags, and one was labeled cat food and one was labeled dog food. And you pick them up for whichever particular species you happen to have. And again, now we know that, the dog is much more omnivorous in nature, more similar. They're both certainly on the carnivore side of the spectrum, but the dog is more omnivorous than the cat. The cat is an obligate carnivore who has to have certain animal products in their diet. and the dog can pretty much, you know, easily live as a vegetarian, although they are much happier mm-hmm. with some carnivorous nature in their diet.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's an interesting change. And really, the pet food industry in the last 15 to 20 years has just expanded immensely, pretty much following, I think, the importance of pets in our society in general.
Would you say the quality of pet food has increased correspondingly with that attention?
Definitely. Yeah. When pet foods were first manufactured, they were manufactured as a byproduct of other industries. You know, well, we have this stuff left over, let's make a dog food. Today we have several companies, you know, of the premium pet foods whose primary interest is producing good dog and cat food and in conducting research in those areas.
We have a couple callers waiting. We'll include them, and we'll go next to a listener in Aurora on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes, thank you. I have a Cocker Spaniel male, 5 years old, and he has a terrible case of tartar on his teeth,
mm-hmm.
and I am going to get him to the vet tomorrow, hopefully.
Okay.
But I have had dogs. I had a Cairn Terrier, English Springer, and a Terrier, and they never had gum problems.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been trying to analyze this. What have I done different with this dog? He gets IAMs and Purina dog chow.
Okay. Do you feed it dry? Or?
The dry.
Okay.
Oh, yes, the dry.
Okay.
And the thing that I have found that I'm doing differently with this dog is I am not giving him real bones. I used to get these huge real bones from the grocer, the meat man, and I would boil them off, make soup out of them, and then give them to the dogs.
Mm-hmm.
I always made sure the size of the bone fit the dog or larger. And I never had gum problems, never had teeth problems, nothing. And I've been giving the dog these chews and the Nyla bones, and sometimes he'll chew them and sometimes he won't.
Okay.
I get these very good dog biscuits from a special place, the large ones. And this is the first time I've had trouble with gums.
And you said how old is the dog?
5.
5. Is there inflammation in his gums that you could tell?
Well, there's a very bad odor.
Oh, okay. Definitely get him to the vet. You probably have some periodontal disease occurring.
Yes.
And first of all, the difference could very simply be genetic. Dogs differ greatly in how susceptible they are to calculus buildup, gingivitis, and periodontal disease. So it does tend to be seen more often in small breeds that have a more brachiocephalic face, that have a squished-in nose. One of the theories on that is that when we neotenized the dog, when we turned him into a little puppy, and we squished down his face, we kept the same number of teeth in that muzzle. And so the smaller breeds, while their teeth size is slightly smaller, their teeth are cramped in a smaller space. So one of the theories is that perhaps those breeds are more susceptible to gingivitis, to periodontal disease, to calculus development, because they're smaller muzzle, that basically there are more teeth in a smaller space. It's hard to say, really. There also just seems to be differences between individual dogs, that some are more susceptible than others. Cocker Spaniels are definitely a breed that you're going to see more problems in. It's a really interesting...
I have already. I am very unhappy. Every month it's something else.
Well, this particular problem in general is very curable and certainly is manageable.
How can you get it not to recur? You say manageable.
Okay, I'm going to tell you that. If you take him into the vet and have him checked, he will probably have to put him under anesthetic and clean his teeth and remove that tartar. What happens with periodontal disease is that starts to go up under the gum, and that will actually start to decay the periodontal ligament. And that can be very serious for the dog. He might actually lose some teeth. Once your veterinarian's done that, he will probably give you some solution. One of the best solutions to use is a solution that has chlorhexidine in it. It's an antibacterial agent. And then you should periodically, if you can, 2 or 3 times a week, brush his teeth with that. You're doing everything right in giving him hard things to chew on. He should have any type of hard bone. If you mentioned that he doesn't always chew on those, I would probably recommend that You get a hard bone. They're true hard bones and sterilized bones that you can get in any pet store, and you can stuff them with things in the end to entice them to chew on those. There's actually quite a bit of research right now showing that it's not the food per se, it's how many, they actually call them chewing episodes, a dog has per day. The more often a dog has the opportunity to chew, the better able he is to remove that calculus that's starting to form on his teeth. And that, in conjunction with brushing, is what's going to solve your problem for you. You will have to probably be pretty diligent after you start this with him. But I think that if you have it taken care of since he's only 7, hopefully he won't lose too many teeth, and then you stay on top of it, you should do just fine. Otherwise, you're doing everything right. You know, you're giving him a dry food, you're giving him chewing episodes. Probably the only thing I would add to that is have periodic checks with your vet. He probably will have to have a once or twice a year cleaning, and then also start brushing his teeth.
Hope it gets at the caller's question, and I hope you'll forgive me for moving on. We have several other people waiting, and we'll go next to a listener in Chicago on line number 1. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes. In this country, some animals are treated better than humans. Your prize racehorses, for example, owned by the rich. But I'd like to ask you, what's about the average temperature of a cat, about 2 years old, 102, I've heard?
About 101.5, but 102 would still be normal.
Yeah, well, lady vet told me that they could stand something 0 to 10 below. You know, it wouldn't affect them adversely.
You mean...
In a garage, you know. I mean, in this kind of weather now, up in northern Illinois now, it's pretty cold to have them outside, you know.
Sure, sure. I'm not sure. Is your question, are you keeping a cat outside, or?
No, I'm not. I didn't say that, did I?
No.
No, just trying to figure out where you're going with that.
But where I'm going, well, I'm just asking, is it 0 to 10 below okay in a garage?
Personally, I wouldn't want to keep a cat in those conditions. No, I think the cat might survive if he had enough food and the water was kept from freezing, but it certainly wouldn't be a pleasant survival.
Oh, 0 degrees okay?
Again, personally, no. I wouldn't allow a cat to live in those conditions.
Oh, well, yeah. Well, the temperature's much higher than that. That's sort of a hypothetical question, right?
Mm-hmm.
But
cat probably could survive if there was shelter, enough food. They would need a lot more calories to keep their body temperature up.
This Farm and Fleet, this farm chain store outfit, they put out a, call it a balanced, healthy formula. It contains natural turkey, fish, and milk flavor, sure to win your cat's favor. That's pretty good to feed them?
It's probably what is called a name brand. It's probably a generic food.
It's high protein, 31.5%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, again, that's fine for a cat, but if it's a product that has a name brand on it, a price brand from...
brand. It's just their brand.
Exactly. So that means it's a generic pet food, so it's probably not a real high-quality food. It would not be a good food to feed a cat in those conditions because generally they're very low in digestibility, so the cat's not going to be able to get enough nutrients for the bulk that's in the diet.
Okay, but the cat was raised on that from being a kitten.
Mm-hmm.
That and water, they don't need really any milk, right?
No, they don't need milk. Water's
fine.
That's
right. Yeah, milk in this type of diet. Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Well, let's talk about that for a second. We're talking about, whether it's Farm and Fleet or Walmart, who knows what store label. This is essentially a generic food that has been packaged for that chain or outlet.
Exactly, right.
And what would we say about that? I mean, it's, perhaps, fine, but on the other hand, it's not as good as something you'd buy.
It's kind of the same as for humans. We're careful about what we buy, according to what we know about that food. Generic foods are typically produced on a cost basis, that they're produced to make the lowest cost food. And so as a result, their ingredients are going to tend to be less digestible. The amount of testing, and I think personally, I think that's of greatest concern, is that the amount of testing is probably going to be minimal in most cases. The only difference between a price brand, such as the gentleman was just describing, and a generic is that, as you said, this company has just paid a little bit more to put their house label, their house name on that brand. There are actually some controlled studies that have looked at generic pet foods, and there was actually a term coined, generic dog food disease, in which a number of young dogs were raised on a generic food, and it was found that they developed deficiency signs that appeared to be signs of zinc deficiency. It's theorized that the reason for this was that many low-quality foods tend to include meat and bone meal. And meat and bone meal can, if it's a low-quality meat and bone meal, have a lot more bone than meat, and that can really increase the calcium levels quite high. If that's the case, calcium can then bind zinc and make that unavailable to the dog while they're growing. It was theorized that that was what caused it in these dogs, but we really can't say because it wasn't controlled to the point at which all the nutrients were controlled in the diet. It was just generic food versus some other foods. So that was kind of the benchmark study to, you know, make us all realize as nutritionists that, you know, it does make a difference where these nutrients come from for the dogs and the cats, that they cannot efficiently digest all types of protein, you know, no matter what you put in there. So generally speaking, using the example that was just given to us, for a cat in those conditions, the cat's going to have to severely increase their caloric intake to try and keep their body temperature up in order to live in those conditions. So the amount of food that cat has to eat in order to meet those needs is going to be a great amount of food. They're going to have more difficulty getting those nutrients out of a poorly digested food.
In general, would you say stay away from generic food?
Yeah, in general, I would say good adage is you do get what you pay for in terms of pet food, in that if you want to buy food that's been more highly tested in animals, that the manufacturer is standing behind it. One of the things also that premium foods manufacturers will do is they put a lot of effort into educating veterinarians and educating their consumers, not just about their food. Of course, they're in the business of selling food, but also about good nutrition. So they're going to provide literature. They're also going to provide a 1-800 number for people to call if they have questions about the food. And those are all certainly benefits.
Good. We have a couple callers waiting. We'll go next to someone in southern LaSalle County on line number 2. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning. I've got a water question. I'm not much of a cat person, and I have never had one that for a long, long, long time that would be reproducing. But now I have a young male, and I find it's a struggle to get water outside when he's outside, and then I have him very controlled circumstance during the cold of the night in a better than a garage situation. And even when the water is available, it just seems like he drinks next to nothing. I want to know, is that the amount that cats use? And the other question is, with probably very old house dogs, small, I know this little old lady, she likes to put something into the dog dish when she doesn't want any more of the food, like, I've had enough of this stuff. But why do even younger dogs cover over the water or try to put something into the water? I have gotten so I don't give too much water, and I put a foam tray over it that they can nudge it out when they really want water. Thank you, and I'll hang up.
Sure. Regarding the first question for the male cat, cats actually evolved from a desert animal, from the African wildcat. So they do have pretty low water requirements. Without, you know, you giving me an actual quantity that the cat is consuming, I can't say whether it's enough or not. Chances are he's doing just fine. The only problem might be male cats, depending on what he's being fed, do have a problem. It's a very common problem called fluted or feline lower urinary tract disorder, in which they can actually develop certain types of crystal in their lower urinary tract, and that can cause blockage, and it can lead to urolithiasis or, certainly lower urinary tract infections. But it doesn't sound like he's having any of those problems. You didn't mention that. So I would think he's probably fine. And I wasn't sure what you meant about having a problem with having water outside for him, if you meant that it freezes or what the situation there is. But I think that it sounds like you're being very diligent in making sure he has enough water. He's probably self-regulating just fine, you know, if you're not seeing any other health problems.
Okay, good. We have another call, and I'll get right to them. I'm sort of interspersing a few questions because I want to make sure we cover some of the territory that we set out to do. We're talking about the quality of feed. Testing is a real issue when it comes to different sources of dog food, and the different ways that it is tested might be something people should know about.
Yeah, and actually that is one of the ways that the label can help them. Right now, the Association of American Feed Control Officials, which is called AFCO, is one of the primary regulators of what can and cannot be on a pet food label. And there are two primary ways that a pet food manufacturer can substantiate their label claim. And what that means is that most people are familiar with the label claim that says, I grew up with this, so I always remember it, this food has been determined to be complete and balanced for all life stages of the dog. That all life stages claim, if we think about it, is a really amazing claim to make, you know, that we can say, here's a food that we've formulated, and you can start feeding it to your puppy, and you can feed it throughout life to your adult elderly dog, and the dog should maintain optimal health. So AFCO says, well, you know, if you're going to make a claim like that, you have to substantiate it somehow. And there are two ways in which pet food manufacturers can do that. They can either do it through conducting a series of feeding trials or feeding protocols that AFCO has set out and said, you have to feed this food after you formulate it and make it, feed this food to this number of animals throughout all life stages. So if you're making a life stages claim, it has to be fed to, if we're talking about dogs, to a dog throughout gestation or her pregnancy, lactation, so when she has her puppies, and then to the resultant puppies for a minimum of 10 weeks. And not only do they need to maintain health in a, you know, just looking at them in normal growth, but also AFCO designates certain health parameters that they must meet as far as taking blood and certain other ways in which we can measure health as they're growing. The second way, so that's kind of the premium way, because it's certainly going to cost the pet food manufacturer more money to maintain a kennel, and if they're not maintaining a kennel, to farm that out, to have someone else do that testing for them. And it certainly takes an amount of time, because you're feeding to a large number of animals throughout these life stages. But it is going to give you a good measure. Nothing gives you a better measure of the quality of a food than feeding it. The second method is called the calculation method, and that method says that the company can formulate the pet food on paper and then compare the nutrient levels as they've calculated them to a set of nutrient profiles. And the nutrient profiles were developed by a number of nutritional experts, both from academia and from the pet food industry, who said these are the minimum levels of these essential nutrients that need to be in a food to maintain optimal health in dogs and cats. So by that method, the manufacturer can say these are our levels in our food, and they match. They meet what nutrient profiles are, AFCO nutrient profiles. For that method, the consumer will see something on the label that reads something to the effect, this food has been determined to be complete and balanced for all life stages through meeting AFCO nutrient profiles. If the first method was used, the feeding protocols, the label will read something to the effect of, this food has been determined to be complete and balanced through AFCO feeding trials or AFCO feeding protocols. So if the consumer looks for that key term, you know, feeding trials or feeding protocols, that's kind of the higher level, the higher standard that a pet food company is upholding. And so I think that's a really good rough estimate that you're getting at least a food that's been fed to a number of animals that's been proven to be complete and balanced.
Very good. Well, there's more to talk about on that that subject, but let's talk with another caller, listener in Mansfield, next on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Well, thank you. I had a question about, we have an adult large cat, overweight probably. He's about over 10 pounds, and we've always fed him like Whiskas, you know, commercial foods. And his eating habits changed, and my husband started giving him more of those pounce. And in fact, he preferred those, and I also switched to IAMs then, thinking that I would balance this. And he now has, we took him to the vet, he started having diarrhea, and the vet said that he had an infected anal gland. But would that change in diet, too many pounds of treats, and then, you know, he's not interested much in cat food anymore, in the IAMs. So I'm confused now as to how to feed him.
And how old is he, did you say?
He was a stray, so he's over 7 years old.
Okay.
But I don't know exactly how old.
And when you said, 10 pounds for a big cat would not be hugely overweight. Is he a small-boned cat? Or?
Yes, he is a small-boned cat.
Okay, so he would consider him pretty overweight.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And he also has always eaten compulsively. I mean, whenever he's nervous, he runs and eats.
Oh, and he stopped doing that?
No, my husband gives him cat treats.
Okay. What happens if you just withhold the cat treats?
He won't eat very much.
How long have you tried to do that?
It's been about 2 months.
No, I mean, how long have you withheld the treats to see if he'd start to eat again?
About 2 weeks.
And he didn't eat the whole 2 weeks?
Well, he would just nibble, and, not with any enthusiasm like he used to.
Okay.
I don't think he likes the iams.
Okay. Did you try going back to the whiskas?
No, we haven't.
Okay. There's a couple of things probably to think about here. One is that cats are notorious for becoming single food preference eaters.
Okay.
And if they, especially if they have started a single food as kittens and gone on with that single food, it's sometimes very, very difficult to get them to change foods.
Okay.
So that it might be that he has just a very strong food preference. Okay. And especially if you did you say you did have him from a kitten or
no? He was several years old when he just kind of adopted.
Okay. So you could have a cat that just has some strong food preferences. As far as the anal gland goes, being involved in this, the only way that it's possible in my mind that it could be is if he decreased his food intake to the degree that he didn't defecate as frequently. One of the things that normal defecation does is it expresses the anal glands.
Uh-huh.
That could have led to the infected anal gland. It's probably, a contributor, not the primary cause, though. Sometimes, dogs and cats just get infected anal glands. What I guess I would suggest, the pounce treats very well might be complete and balanced. Many treats are.
Uh-huh.
So it might not hurt him at all, to exist on those.
Uh-huh.
But it might not be the best food for him either. So what I probably would try would be just withholding those treats, going back to his whiskas.
Uh-huh.
If he just nibbles, actually that's actually more normal cat eating than the voracious eating that you mentioned. Cats are nibblers by nature. They are not, we tend to think, oh, they were like the lion. They went out and hunted. But actually, their ancestor, the African wildcat, eats by eating a lot of mice all day long. So they were nibblers as well, just they nibbled on mice. So the nibbling is very natural. The only concern I would have and I'd watch for is that when cats are obese, if they suddenly become stressed and stopped eating, they're very susceptible to a problem called hepatic lipidosis, which is very serious. And so if he stopped eating completely, then you might want to, you kind of play this game of then pull out the pounce and give him a couple. You want to avoid him, just stopping eating completely. But I guess if he nibbled, the first time you tried to withhold the pounce, I would go back and try that and just try and get him back on his normal food.
He also has a sort of diarrhea off and on, and I just blame the treats for that.
It could be, yeah. Okay. One of the things when pet food manufacturers create treats, unlike balanced food, their primary concern with a treat is getting something that the cat or the dog's just going to go wild over.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, cats are a little more finicky than dogs, so it's been more of a challenge for pet food manufacturers. And what typically they'll do with cat foods is make them very high in fat. So
okay.
They're usually high in fat to begin with and then coated with some fat.
Oh.
So it might be a little bit that he just can't handle a large number of those. It also very simply could be just changing, from a normal food to the pounce and back and forth could precipitate some diarrhea.
And then I also read in a magazine, and one time it said that if you have an obese cat, you should feed the cat and then take the food away, not leave, food out all day. Is
mm-hmm.
that true, or should a cat have access to food all day?
If the cat can self-regulate,
mm-hmm.
that is the best way to feed them because that's how they prefer to eat, to nibble. But it sounds like he doesn't self-regulate if he's obese. So then you might want to offer multiple small meals per day.
Okay.
But again, if you withhold the pounce, you might find that, I wouldn't withhold the pounce and change your feeding regimen at the same time.
Okay.
I would withhold the pounce, leave his food out, and then once he's back on normal eating, if you want to go to meal feeding, then I would.
Okay, well, thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thanks for the call. We're well past our midpoint with Linda Case, animal companion instructor at the University of Illinois. We're talking about nutrition for your animal companions, and we have a couple callers and about maybe 15 minutes left. The number around Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to join us, 333-9455. Toll-free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. Well, I have more questions, but we have a couple of people waiting, so we'll defer to them. Next up, listener in Savoy on line number two. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes, thank you. I had just a comment and then a couple of questions. The woman earlier who called in about her chow with the coat problems, I'm wondering if this might be of help. I had a similar situation with my Samoyed. I have two Samoyeds, and she had a very poor coat for a long time and was finally tested for a thyroid, and that was found to be low. Mm-hmm. She's been on thyroid medication for about a year and 2 years, and as soon as she was put on that, she got a very thick, nice undercoat for the first time on her belly.
Mm-hmm.
Then she was shaved for ultrasound. She had to be tested for some abdominal problems a year ago, and the fur on her belly basically never grew back.
Mm.
And she's been looked at by the dermatologist at the U of I Small Animal Clinic, who said now, and her thyroid's been rechecked, she thinks it's probably a hormonal problem, that she could go through a blood panel,
mm-hmm,
to check for a hormonal imbalance, but it would primarily be for cosmetic purposes,
mm-hmm,
at this point.
Sure.
So I just thought I'd throw that in. I don't know if that would be applicable to the chow.
It's a good point.
I know they're a breed that is related,
sure,
both in the Spitz class. And I wanted to just suggest that, too, that she may want to ask about that as a possibility.
Sure, I think that's a good suggestion.
And then I had a question on the feeding of both of my dogs. They've gone through cycles of diarrhea and vomiting in the past, and they've been put on WD, and it's a prescription diet.
Mm-hmm.
And recently I tried very, very gradually to change to Science Diet Senior,
mm-hmm,
for both of them, and this precipitated a terrible bout of vomiting and diarrhea,
mm-hmm,
in one of the dogs. And we just got over that and back onto WD, which seems to have calmed things down.
Mm-hmm.
And I've noticed it does have that AFCO statement that it says it provides a complete and balanced nutrition for the maintenance of adult dogs. Is WD going to be okay if I continue giving it indefinitely? It seems to be the only thing that both of them can tolerate,
sure,
and I,
sure,
think they both have a fat intolerance.
Mm-hmm. Are they related to each other, the two dogs?
No, they're not.
Oh, okay. It does sound like a food intolerance. Do you have any skin signs with when they react to...
No,
okay,
don't have any skin signs. It really just hits the digestive tract,
sure,
and it does so very dramatically if,
okay,
I do any change at all.
Yeah, and that does sound more, you know, we tend to think, oh, food allergy, but actually food allergies when they're in dogs, typically 95% of the cases and 90% of the cases show up as skin, inflammatory skin problems,
mm-hmm,
and that vomiting and diarrhea are secondary. So the description sounds like some type of food intolerance,
mm-hmm,
especially since it's so dramatic and so it happens so quickly.
So I'd call it a food intolerance.
Right. And, you know, that's kind of just academic saying,
okay,
which it is.
Yeah.
But it's the same as with a food allergy. Then what you end up doing is you test until you find a food that the animal will tolerate.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of the good thing with an intolerance is that if there's just for some reason these dogs are not tolerating something in the previous diets, usually then once you find a diet you can stay with that indefinitely and they'll do fine.
Okay.
So I would say, you know, since it is and it, you do see an AFCO statement that says it's complete and balanced, they should just do fine. You know, it's basically one of those, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Yeah,
you know,
okay,
that if they're doing well, then goodness, it's great that they
okay,
found a food that works for them.
It is pretty high fiber, and I got concerned earlier when you mentioned some problems with nutritional uptake in that and wondered if I should supplement it with vitamins or something.
Well, you know, it's a difficult thing to say, you know, to supplement once you've got a balanced food, because then you can set other things out of whack.
It's got everything.
Right,
that
right.
And that's what I was wondering if,
right,
it could be also supplementing.
Yeah, so I would say, you know, since it is working for your dogs and you're not seeing anything other than you mentioned the hair loss, which,
right,
it sounds like you've got an idea of what's causing that.
Yeah, yeah.
Well,
then, are hypoallergenic dog treats okay? I can get those at a specialized store here.
Mm-hmm. The term hypoallergenic is kind of a funny term because it's a misnomer. There's really no such thing.
Okay.
Because it came from the idea that if we find a protein, and typically allergies are usually to proteins, if we find a protein that's novel, that the animal's never been exposed to before, they won't react to it. So originally, lamb was identified as being hypoallergenic for dogs and cats.
Right.
And the reason was that lamb was a novel source. It wasn't typically used in dog and cat food, so no dog or cat had ever been exposed to it, so they didn't react to it, so it was then termed hypoallergenic. So it's only hypoallergenic if your particular animal doesn't react to it. It's defined by the animal that consumes it.
Gotcha.
So,
okay,
so I guess
that's why they also tried them on fish and potatoes.
Mm-hmm. Sure, right. Did that not work, though?
Yeah, it did work for a while. It was just kind of smelly.
Yeah.
And then I got him back onto WD,
yeah.
And I just should have stuck with that. I was just trying to get something where I wouldn't have to drive all the way over to the vets every time I needed the food.
Sure, sure. What you might want to do then is just experiment with some treats, because it just might be since you don't know exactly what it is that they're reacting to,
okay.
It's going to kind of be a hit-or-miss thing.
But it can be, with a food sensitivity, they can have that kind of it was almost very threshold-y because she was doing okay when it was mixed.
Mm-hmm.
Then when I went to complete science diet, it just all hell broke loose. Pardon me.
Yeah. Were they ever tested for pancreatitis or anything like that?
Yeah.
It wasn't?
She had a complete blood panel just
okay.
at the emergency room last week.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So without knowing exactly what it is, I would tell you there's probably something in one of the diets that they're reacting
and just
to.
Stick with what's working.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for the call. We have another caller, and I'll get right to them, but I have to ask one other question that I don't know. I'm interested in, maybe other people would be too. We have two dogs, and one is severely intolerant to the food that we feed the other dog.
Mm-hmm.
So we feed one dog one food, the mm-hmm. other one the other food. And the food that this older dog gets, we buy at the grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
Because they don't sell it at the feed store. In fact, last time I went to the feed store, I asked for this particular food, and the person said, "Oh no, we don't sell that here."
Heavens no!
No, my goodness. And what's the deal there? I mean, is this such a horrible food that feed stores won't touch it? I mean,
there's probably a little bit of professional snobbery there. You know? I think that there's this idea that premium foods are sold through pet stores
right.
and through veterinarians and through feed stores, mm-hmm. and that the grocery store products are one step down. But as you probably know, there's one premium food right now that has just made it into pet food stores in the last 6 months. I won't name names, but so that line is definitely blurring
yeah.
Between that. And most grocery store foods, if it's produced by a national manufacturer that's a well-recognized name, if it has the AFCO testing on it, the thing to keep in mind with grocery store brands, the main difference is that perhaps their quality might be a tad lower, but nothing probably that's going to affect the animal that much. But what more of their budget goes into is name recognition, advertising, and consumer appeal, making it look pretty for the owner who's buying it. And but as far as nutritional value, they're probably moderately high. They may not be as high as the premium foods, but for the vast majority of dogs, they're going to do just fine. So again, if your dog's doing well on it, and you can stand not being, someone being snooty to you in the pet store, I would continue to get what you get for.
Right. Well, this is something I learned from reading part of your book, was that premium dog foods, they make those expressly. I mean, that's their business. That's
mm-hmm.
all they essentially do.
Right.
And they're very careful with their ingredients, that it's consistent
mm-hmm.
from batch to batch, from
right.
year to year,
yeah,
and so forth.
Formulation.
And that's not always the case with
right.
other kinds of food.
Yeah, with some foods, and again, this is something that you really can't tell from the label unless
yeah.
you buy several different, if you continue to buy that food for a while, that they'll have a formulation that's not fixed, that basically if different grains, for example, would change in market value during the time when a batch is being produced, they may switch and use that grain versus one they had been using, or a different form of a grain as well. And again, for the vast majority of dogs, it probably won't make a big difference. For some, it might, you know, that are have a little bit more finicky GI tract, or maybe have some type of food intolerance or food allergy.
So how do you tell?
You can't unless you just get bag to bag to bag. Most of the premium foods will guarantee that. Mm-hmm. They will say, we do not change our food unless you see a label claim that we've changed it. And that's called a fixed formulation. So that's, again, one of those mm-hmm. other little things that you're paying a little bit more for, in addition to a little bit more testing, a little more education to the consumer. That's another thing that your pennies are going for with a premium food.
Good. We have one more caller. We'll squeeze in a listener in Wellington on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes, well, we have a couple cats, and they are my husband's kind of business cats. And they've kind of, particularly one of them, we think it's the male. They're both, they were litter mates, and they're about 2.5 years old. And they're both been neutered. One's a female and one's a male. But we give them they drink quite a bit of, you know, actually quite a bit of water. And particularly in the summertime, they did it for a while, and then they kind of stopped, and now they're starting to do it again. They just kind of mess in their water, or will kind of tip the bowl or something.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this time of year it isn't so bad, but in the summertime when it's hot, you know, and if we would go away for a whole day, they might then, you know, if we have them cooped up, they might be, you know, get short of water.
Oh, but because they spill it?
Pardon? Yeah, they just spill it. Or sometimes they'll just kind of bat it around with their paws mm-hmm. and spill it or mess around it in general. Is this just kind of boredom or...
Yeah, I would say it's probably some play behavior, boredom, and if it's hot, they might be just doing it to stay cool. You know, dogs and cats don't have as efficient cooling mechanisms as we do, so it might be just simply, you know, just for cooling. I guess what I would recommend if you're afraid that's going to happen is to put several bowls out, you know,
uh-huh.
you know, multiple bowls to make sure that, you know, that they have enough water.
Well, it just seemed to, in general, just kind of make a mess.
Yeah. They're doing it to annoy you, I'm sure.
Is there any, you know, other than that, is there any way that we could kind of curb this behavior in them?
You might want to see if there are some toys, because it could be an activity thing. Do they tend to do it when no one's around?
Well, yes and no. And they're, you know, they're in and out. They can go in and out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we've been keeping them pretty much in now. It's been so terrible cold.
Sure.
And but, you know, they're free to go in and out as they please. And, you know, there's quite a bit of activity in and out of my husband's business.
Right.
So there's somebody, you know, he isn't sitting there petting them all the time. But,
right.
you know, there's somebody around most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll still do it sometimes when, you know,
there's activity.
Yeah.
You could play around with different types of water bowls. You know, get a fixed water bowl that's, you know, fixed to something so they can't move it.
Okay.
Or a raised water bowl. You know, you could kind of play around with that, with how they obtain water. And then again, I guess, you know, my big concern personally would be that they get enough water.
Right.
So, you know, that you put several bowls out. And then, you know, maybe you have one in an area that you don't really care if it gets messy, and that can be their play bowl. And then have another bowl somewhere else, you know, that is fixed, that you know they can't mess with and can get a source of water.
What would you think of something, you know, we try to change the water real often so it's not fresh or anything. What would you think of something like my husband's left someplace out in the country where they had it as an outdoor feeder, but we could use it perhaps indoors that way? Something like a chicken feeder where, you know, the water was kind of inside and then it kind of come out in like a little tray more.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I think that would be fine if it was always available to them. What doesn't work well for dogs and cats are those feeders that they have to lick at to obtain, because they just can't obtain enough.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't recommend that.
This is kind of like a little trough around the edge.
Yeah, as long as there's enough water, I think it would be fine.
Because the bowl I've got, it's about 6 inches across and about 4 inches deep, and I thought that would be, you know, heavy enough. It's more like a dog food
sure.
bowl, but I thought it would be heavy enough, you know, that they wouldn't do that.
Right. Yeah, they're probably just developed an enjoyment of playing in water.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks a lot for the call. And we're at the end of our time, so we're going to have to stop. I have more questions. We'll have to save until next time, huh?
That'd be great.
Okay. Our guest has been Linda Case, and she is a companion animal instructor at the University of Illinois, among other things, a textbook author and dog trainer and many other things. And I'm sure we'll do this again soon. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Jack.